Hi, this is Larry Goldfarb, and welcome to Wrestling for Higher Consciousness. And today I'm joined by Steve Sashin, the co-founder of Zero Shoes. And why don't you tell us what Zero Shoes are? I think you'll probably do a better job than me.
Well, when people ask me what I do for a living, I usually respond by asking them a question, and I say, "So, do your feet feel better at the end of the day than they did at the beginning of the day?" And invariably, people say no, and I say that's because your shoes aren't letting your feet do what's natural, which is letting your toes spread, letting them bend and flex and move, and most importantly, feel. And so, we make shoes that let your feet do what's natural that are so comfortable. We've literally had people call us to say that they went to bed still wearing their shoes because they forgot they had them on, not because they passed out drunk, which is another way that probably could happen. And so we make shoes, boots, and sandals that people use, both performance and casual, that people use for everything from taking a walk to chilling out to running 100-mile ultramarathons across Madagascar.
Wow. Yeah, and I have to say I am I've test driven your shoes. I have, and I bought, I think the Oswegos, right?
There's a pair of those down here.
Yeah, exactly, those right behind you. And I got the Colorado or Denver's or something too, and the Oswegos have not left my feet. They are just
They're
They're really,
like slippery. They're
they're
like slipper
great.
you could run a marathon.
Yeah, they're just and I have a complicated history with my feet because I have both structural and neurological things going on there. And I was at the podiatrist the other day. I used to work at a podiatry hospital in the rehab medicine department. And I have a great respect for podiatrists. And my podiatrist is pretty conservative. So I was telling, we're talking about options, and I was telling her about those shoes, and she's like, "Your shoes, you know?" And she's like, "Oh no, I don't recommend those." I just didn't say anything. I'm like, "Well, I do, but too bad for you." But I have to say, I'm so happy. My feet are happy.
Well, I'm happy to hear it, and I got to tell you, there are the entire global footwear industry is like $500 billion a year, and my wife likes to point that out to say that means there's more than enough shoe companies in the world, unless what you're doing changes people's lives. And we hear emails or get emails and get testimonials and reviews and phone calls from people every day saying what you just said and much, much more. And that's what gets us out of bed in the morning because, frankly, running a business is super hard. Running a footwear company is unbelievably hard. And if it weren't for the response that people have, we wouldn't do this. And back to your podiatrist, of course, it's hysterical because podiatrists, it's that old line, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so when podiatrists, there's two groups. There's some who understand the value of letting your body do what bodies are supposed to do. And there's some who think that everything needs some sort of orthopedic intervention and for which they charge you money. And it's hard to make money by telling someone, just go take off your shoes and go for a walk barefoot. That'll build up intrinsic foot muscle strength and you should be fine. They don't get paid for that. They get paid to put you in an orthotic, typically, which inhibits motion and inhibits feedback, the two things that there's research. Some people put orthotics in the shoes of healthy athletes, and within 10 weeks, they had lost up to 10% of their intrinsic foot muscle volume and strength. How can that be good? And not feeling your brain, you have more nerve endings in the soles of your feet than anywhere but your fingertips and your lips. Clearly, you're supposed to use these things at the end of your legs, and one of the big things they do is tell your brain what's happening at the other end of your body, so it knows how to work with everything in between. And if you put something hard and plastic in there, it loses that information. And how can that be good? Unless you're dealing with some, massive structural thing or an injury you need to recover. But as soon as you can, you want to get out of that and into something that lets your feet move and function.
It makes so much sense to me because when I worked in the podiatry hospital, their interventions were orthopedics, medication, surgery,
Right.
right? And I think what you and I both share is this perspective on function, on how we move and how important that is.
Yeah.
And my personal aha about that is actually thanks to trying to think of his first name, Hundertwasser Friedens, what is it? Friedensreich, who do you know the SAG?
No.
So Hundertwasser is a he's a an Austrian artist. He's really known for his paintings of whales and other sea mammals. But it turns out he was an architect. I didn't know this till I was working in the Feldenkrais training in Vienna back in the early 90s. He has a museum, Kunsthaus Wien, Art House Vienna. And so this guy's built all kinds of things. So the his museum is really interesting. His interest is in humans' relationships with nature. And so his the houses he has built are into hillside. I mean, all kinds of cool things. But his museum, he says that flat floors are unnatural. They cut us off from the world. And so his museum has a floor that's uneven, right? And so you are tactically and kinesthetically stimulated as you walk through the museum. It's such an amazing experience. I mean, I would love to take my Zero shoes for a walk there because that would be interesting. But our relationship to everything that happens above
Yeah.
is coordinated by our relationship to the floor, to
Yeah.
whatever surface we're on. So that feedback is so important. Not just the intrinsic muscles of the foot, but also what happens at your ankle joints, let's say,
Everything, all
right?
the, you know, the thing I say is if you don't let your foot do its job, bending, flexing, moving, feeling, all that function tries unsuccessfully to move upstream into your ankle, your knee, your hip, your back. So what we do, we try to let your foot do its job so the rest of your body can do its job. And to your point about flat floors, it's funny. I spent a lot of time barefoot and in places where people think you're not allowed to be barefoot. One time I walked into Costco not too long ago and they stopped me and said, "Is everything okay?" I said, "Yeah, why?" They said, "You're wearing shoes." And they were mine. But what's so fun walking barefoot into Costco is there's the sensations of the parking lot, which is different than the sensations of the sidewalk, which is different than the sensations of the very smooth, flat, cool floor. And each one of them is really, really fun for completely different reasons. And that's the part that we lose. Look, even in a pair of Zero shoes, which gives you a lot of feedback, but it's not the same as being barefoot, where you're getting, you know, just tremendous amounts of information, tremendous amounts of feedback. And just I'll tell the story in this way. My first barefoot run, which was over, geez, trails and grass and gravel and wooden bridges and everything you could think of, was so enthralling because I was feeling so many different things that I had never felt before. And I'm a
Right.
sprinter. I run the 100 meters. This we did this run. I was just so entranced. At the end of the run, someone had a GPS watch on. I said, "How far was that?" She goes, "It's a little over 5K." I was like, "I'm sorry, what?" I mean, I had never run more than a mile of my own volition before that and did not enjoy that. But getting all that information, it's just your brain. I'll say it this way. This is going to sound funny. Sugar doesn't taste sweet. It doesn't taste good. What happened is we evolved to like the taste of sugar because it gave us something we need, aka calories. Well, we're getting something we need when our feet are feeling the ground, especially on surfaces that are pleasant. And we've lost that. We've missed out on that. And to reclaim that, to get that again, your brain just lights up. I had someone contact me recently. She said, "My first 3 days in your shoes, my feet felt a little sore, like I'd gone to the gym. By the fourth day, I just wanted more." And I said, "Yeah, been there, done that."
Well, what I take particular delight in what you just said, Stephen, because there's the mechanical part of moving, which is so important,
Yeah.
but there's also the juiciness of it, the lived experience of that, right? And this idea that our bodies are meant not just to give us information, but to be pleasurable.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And I mean, I my downstairs of my house, I live in California, and it's a cement, it's cement, it's hard. And my feet, I don't it can be cold. I don't really like it when the floor's cold. And there's certain things about what's going on with my feet that it's not so pleasant sometimes. And I find wearing the Zero shoes, it's like I don't need support. I need movement.
Right. Well, I want to back up to something you just said about that sort of, you know, that juicy feeling good thing. This is one of the reasons that I love Feldenkrais work, because when you have that unexpected extra movement that you hadn't had a moment earlier, I mean, that in that that feeling, that endorphin rush. You and I talked about this before. I had some sessions back in 1989 with Tom Hanna. It was my first introduction to this work at all. And I had a really tight, screwy lat for whatever reason. I was an All-American gymnast way back when. And so he has me reaching, and I could get however far I could get. And then he does whatever the hell he does, and suddenly I'm reaching a foot farther. And the foot farther was one thing, but like the rush that I got from that was just, I mean, I can feel it now just thinking about it. It was one of the most exciting moments of my life. That sounds crazy. Just to feel what happens when your body lets go like that.
Yeah, I think that there, Feldenkrais talked about this thing of the elusive obvious, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one aspect of that is you get this, that's like I could have had a VA, like, oh my gosh, yeah, moment, yeah, like yeah, where yeah. you realize what's possible. And
right. It's amazing. I mean, it really, yeah. and to your point, I mean, we've lost a lot. I mean, but one of the things we've lost is the experience of that, the repeated experience of that, to understand that when we do have something going on, there may be another way, or to bring attention to that in different ways. We get into these habitual patterns, and because they've become habitual, we don't notice them. But because we don't have a language or a shared experience, or I can't think of the phrase I'm looking for, but just this basic understanding that there are habitual things that are malleable and very pleasurably so, we don't have any practice for becoming aware of those things right. other than pain and then right. going into a different experience. And this is one of the things, backing up to being barefoot or just natural movement, is that you start becoming aware of more of those because you're getting that information. You start to feel where, I'll say it this way, like the basic instruction for running barefoot is take off your shoes, find a nice, smooth, hard surface, because it's going to give you the most feedback without any things that you're going to step on and get in the way and be problematic. Go for a super short run, like 20 seconds. And if it doesn't feel good, do something different till it does. And many people are so tuned out, they don't even know if something hurts. But the reason that instruction works is when you're running barefoot, doing it wrong is unpleasant. And it's bringing your awareness to a pattern that you didn't know you had. And doing it right feels great. And it's bringing your awareness to something you didn't know you could do.
And I think, it is so easy when, I like to think of it this way. There's the habit, which is the behavior you keep producing. And then there's the habituation, the yes. perceptual consequence, which I yes. explain in a very complicated scientific way. Because I grew up near Oswego, New York, the shoes I'm wearing, by the way. That I love that. I grew up 11 miles from Oswego. But, we used to say there, it's upstate New York's, we used to say, you don't smell the shit on the farm.
Right.
Right, you get right. used to it. And so what I love about the shoes is, through Feldenkrais, I teach people how to help themselves to do that. But the shoes... they fit that, they support that, and they remind me of ways of moving, right? It's a very gentle reminder. And it's kind of like in hard shoes on flat surfaces, you don't even know what you're missing.
Exactly. My wife, Lena, loves to say that our footwear is basically a coach. But the reality is the footwear is just helping you become your own coach, because you become aware of these things and what to do about them in a very natural way. I mean, if you're going to teach someone a new movement pattern, the ideal thing is to be giving your brain feedback at a level that you can't really intellectually manipulate. It's just, like good or bad, but you don't even know why. And your brain and your body will figure out how to err on the good side, if you will. The way biofeedback works is you're getting information. Like I was one of the early biofeedback pioneers in the 70s. And so one of the things that I learned to do was change temperature in different parts of my body. And you just get feedback about whether it's working or not that is cognitively, what's the word? I can't think of it. It's impossible to understand cognitively. Just like you hear that there's a rising tone and that's supposed to be good and a lowering tone is bad or vice versa. And eventually you somehow figure out how to manipulate that in a way that you can't even really describe other than you say, yeah, I'm just going to change the temperature of my hands by 5 degrees. And then you do a thing and it happens. And I mean, I actually have some ideas of what's happening and how, but that's because I'm a dork and I just like to really dive in deeper. But fundamentally, you know, you give your brain information and it will figure out patterns well in advance of you ever getting any cognitive or conscious awareness of what's going on.
Yeah. Well, and in that regard, I kind of think of the, you know, your shoe as a low-tech augmented feedback device.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and that's what's really cool about it. Because, you know, it provides feedback and then I get to use it. And it, you know, I have to say I had a little hesitation because my big toe doesn't, it's arthritic. It doesn't bend back as much. And I was like, but, you know, I know being a fellow dork that the pressure on that joint has changed because of the articulation of my whole foot. Right. It's you know, and I have a regular Feldenkrais practice. So, you know, and I'm developing lessons for the classes I teach. So I do my lessons, I put the shoes on. And it's like, wow, the amplification is really cool. So,
and something to pay attention to moving forward. And I'm not making any medical claims or promises, obviously, but when you're in a stiff shoe or with an elevated heel or, you know, something that squeezes your toes together, you're restricting motion in a number of planes. And with the additional motion, with that additional flexibility, you may find a change in the arthritic quality in that first ray simply because it's getting more circulation and more small motion. And over time, that might make an impact. I'm not obviously, again, making promises, but I'd be very curious to hear.
Well, you know, I can tell that the distribution of pressure in all phases of my gait has changed. And it's more after, you know, what I'm looking for when I work with people. And like right now, I'm in the process of teaching people like the perfect COVID lesson, which is done with the student lying on the floor and the teacher holds a board and touches the student's foot. So it's indirect, but it's this whole lesson about kind of re-engaging the intelligence of the foot and eliciting the foot's ability to influence the what's going on with the whole rest of the body. So you're talking to the brain through the foot, through a board. And it's like, you know, what the board is facilitating, it's like educating the person to what movements are possible. It's like the like I think of these things as they go together so well, right? Because what you learn on the lying on the table, you can take with you into walking, and the shoes support that. And look, go ahead, please.
Well, I would contend that depending on the board, that there's going to be enough little variegation in the surface that's a part of what's helpful as well, because you're going to feel just these, you know, little, I mean, unless there's no way you're going to have something so smooth that it feels totally flat. But no one's going to pay attention to this. They're just going to know, oh, I'm stepping on wood. And that's what wood feels like when I step on it. But those little changes in the surface across the plantar surface are going to make a difference.
Well, and the thing is that we use the edges of the board and we use different kinds of contact. So it's a whole conversation with the brain through the muscles to help. Yeah. You know, look, I remember in the podiatry clinic once I was sitting there talking to the guy, the one of the patients in the clinic, and I had that fantastic plastic model of the foot. And I was pointing to it and, you know, as I was talking, and he's just staring at the foot. And I'm like, are you okay? And this guy's like had surgery and whatever. He goes, is that a foot? I said, yeah, these are all the bones of the foot. And he goes, oh, really? I thought a foot was just one bone with a bunch of toes sticking out of it. Right? And if you think, well, that's right. I mean, like that, if that's the image you have and if that fits your experience of your foot, right? How different is it from what you're talking about?
Yeah. When I show people this, they're stunned.
Right.
And because it's instantly obvious that these things are supposed to, you know, move and flex, and they can squish and they can expand. I mean, there's all these things that they can do, and people, and my favorite is actually showing, you know, just those little articulated joints in the tips, which you can't necessarily do anything with, but you know, they're there. That's an actual thing. And then, you know, looking at, and I love showing off the arch too, because when you align the foot properly, it becomes super, super strong, because an arch is a strong structure. Yeah. And so, you know, people are like, they're dumbstruck when they see this because they had no idea. And it's really a shame. I mean, this is, look, I'm not going to say it's pretty, but it's sort of amazing.
It is this design wise, it's beautiful. And you know, my particular interest in it is how the neurological system it developed with the skeletal system. Like there is neuroskeletal evolution. These things, the mechanical structure and the navigational structure, if you will, of the nervous system, yeah, they fit together so beautifully. I will say, I have a range of footwear. I'm more addicted to bags and hats. This is quite obvious, but I'm a bicyclist. I don't own a car. I have clip on bike shoes. So, you know, those are stiff, and I'm glad they're stiff. Right.
Well, pause. So we support a professional cycling team by giving them shoes and sandals to wear when they're off the bike. And one of the guys, they'd finished a ride. And after these rides, they all tend to end up at this one coffee shop in North Boulder. And they took off their cleats and, you know, just were hanging out, and they switched into our shoes. And one of the guys decided, you know, he wasn't going to clip up again to ride home, and noticed on the ride home, he was putting up more watts than he was in his clips, in his wow, cleats. And he was a little stunned by this. I was not, because my theory, and we're going to be testing this, is what he was doing. So when you're in a stiff, flat cycling shoe, your right, foot becomes that single bone and doesn't even have any toes. So, right, but when you actually, you know, are able to use something that's flexible and you can engage this, you can basically make the arch work, which actually helps preload the ankle as well. It makes this whole thing stiffer naturally, and I think would allow you to apply force more effectively than when you're basically, the force is stopping here and the rest of it is just trying to be taken care of by the shoe. That's my theory. And we're going to do some testing to see if we can demonstrate this with more than just that one guy.
Oh, I mean, but so would you build a clip onto a Zero shoe?
Well, he didn't in that situation.
Right.
But yeah, something like that. Yeah, you know.
No, I'd be glad to test drive that. That sounds really cool. I mean, being, you know, who I am, being interested in variety, actually my ex who updated my bike to these clips, I mean, he's the one who taught me about, like, you know, like I play as I'm biking with pushing and pulling and using different parts of my foot. So I'm still articulating my foot and my leg, but I am more than willing to go with your hypothesis. I'm really curious.
The difference is still that when you're in a stiff shoe, mm-hmm, that doesn't let your foot articulate, you can't get it into that stable structure. So there's a physical therapist in Bend, Oregon, who a friend who I adore named Jay DeSherry. We got into this conversation with a bunch of other natural movement people, and he said the articulation of the ankle contributes only 1% of the force in cycling. And I said, that's fine, but I'm not talking about the articulation of the ankle. I'm talking about the transfer of force through the ankle.
Well, and I remember, I don't know if you know Irene Dowd. She's she teaches at what's the art school in New York? She teaches
FIT or
no, dance, music, whatever. I can't think of it.
Juilliard.
She teaches at Juilliard. Thank you. It's CRS. Can't remember shit.
I'm developing a case of that, by the way.
Yeah, I think COVID's helping everybody do that. She came and taught at my Feldenkrais teacher training in New York, and she brought a slightly disarticulated model of the foot, and it was hung together by catgut. And so when you pull on the catgut, you have a structure that is like you're showing this arch, which is really stable. And when you let it go, you have this really droopy, floppy structure. And you can see like there's these two extremes built into kind of the systemic attributes of how the foot can relate to it itself. And so when you're talking about the arch and how it's I would say self-organizing, self-supporting structure, right? And that the structure of the way the shoes move allow us to shift into that gear to elicit that, right? That
Well, I mean, look, let me just show this off because we've been talking about it, but people don't get it. I mean, this is what this shoe can do. And we have things that are even more flexible than that. So that's, that I'm not saying that your foot is ever going to do this. That would be a horrible thing if it did.
That
But
would be.
point is, and it's flexible like that in, every direction you can think of. So what we do, we try to design things that, based on specific use cases, give you the most natural movement possible. And based on where you are in your exploration of natural movement, give you as much or a little bare, well, as much barefoot sensation as possible. So we have hiking shoes that have a slightly like a lugged sole. We have a fully waterproof, what's the word I'm looking for, snow boot that of course is thicker because it's got a fully insulated lining. So there's certain times where being totally barefoot and totally natural and that flexible aren't going to work because of specific use cases. But the whole idea is as soon as you can, get out of those anyway and get back to barefoot. Now, that said, I spent 9 Colorado winters in nothing but either bare feet or sandal, which is just, 4 millimeters of rubber, because you can do that. And what's happened over time, my feet, my circulation has changed. So when I go out on a cold day, my feet feel fine, my hands and my head freezing cold, my feet totally fine.
I had a friend in college who was an ex-Green Beret who was barefoot all the time, and used to relax by climbing the walls of the library at Amherst College. I mean, that was his thing. But I mean, and this was in the 70s, long before I was cool. I mean, they just thought he was crazy. But that was my, anyways, I haven't been, I don't know. I wasn't persuaded by the first bit of the barefoot running stuff. And it was really through our mutual acquaintance, Jay Grunke, who teaches Feldenkrais for runners, that I found out about your shoes. And yeah, they're,
Well,
I'm a,
here's the thing that's so funny about the whole barefoot movement that happened that kicked in around 2009 and really accelerated in 2010. People thought of that as the intervention. They thought, here's this crazy new thing, people
Right.
running barefoot. Well, prior to 1970-ish, most footwear looked like this. And if you want to find people who have like unusually healthy feet, go to a third world country where they don't have shoes. There's a guy who apparently went to Kenya to study the Kenyan army, who the people in the army had spent a lot of time in bare feet before they joined the army. And his report was a podiatrist will go broke in this country. And so for the what people forget is for this much of, human history, we were basically either in bare feet or something barely protecting our feet for this much of that time. Well, actually, for, out of this much of that time, the modern athletic shoe is 50 years old versus 1.5 million years of humans walking around on 2 feet. So where's the intervention? And now what I say to people like from big shoe companies, I just ask them all the time, where's the proof that what you do improves performance or reduces injury? Just show me the study. Just show me anything. You've had 50 years and you've made hundreds of billions of dollars. Clearly by now you must have evidence. The closest thing anyone has ever presented to me is horrifying. Nike did a study, or like Nike likes to say, an independent study was done. They designed it, they paid for it, someone else did it. Doesn't matter. On two shoes, their best-selling motion-controlled shoe and a new shoe that was, quote, designed to reduce injury. Well, no shoe is designed to improve, to increase injury. So that's just specious, but regardless. So in this 12-week study, an injury was counted as anything that took you out for 3 running sessions in a row. So really, the first 10 weeks are the most important in a 12-week study. But let's call it 10 weeks then. In this 10-week study, it's true, their new shoe reduced injury by 50% compared to their best-selling shoe. But here's what they didn't tell you. The best-selling shoe injured over 30% of the people in that 10 weeks. Their new shoe injured only 14.5%. Now, to put that in context, Larry, I'd like to buy you dinner tonight. Which restaurant do you want to go to? The one where you're going to get food poisoning in one out of 7 meals or one out of 3 meals? I mean,
Yeah.
it's reprehensible. It's morally repugnant. It's one of the things that inspires me is I don't like it when people make money by lying to other people.
I want to be very vague about this because I don't want to hurt anybody's feeling, but I remember once many years ago taking dance classes in my college days from someone who was teaching a certain kind of dance that was designed to prevent a certain kind of injury. And I have never been in a course where more people had that injury, right? It was just like, oh my gosh. So the road to hell. And like
Yes.
I was thinking, I watched your now famous Shark Tank interview, pitch. And I love one of the things you said there was that your original design, which was the sandal design, was like, what has been successful since 15,000 BC. I think that was the line. It stuck in my head.
I think it's mankind's favorite footwear since 15,000 BC.
Right.
Or I said, I think another line, I don't know if I said it then, was it's a really simple design. It's not rocket science. Whereas they said back then, it's not rock science.
I missed that one. That's good too.
You might have cut that one
Well,
out. I can't remember.
yeah, it's and that it's interesting because I'm a fan of that show. I missed your episode, but I have watched it since. And yeah, how does it feel to have bested what happened there?
I'll say something revealing about my neurotic psychological patterns. I don't like it when people tell me no for the for bad reasons. And my you know it, and what I often say when someone does that, when someone says, well, I think you're wrong, I go, yeah, you're gonna regret that. It's very motivating for me when someone says it can't be done. And I like that we have, I don't really care, honestly, that we proved them wrong. I mean, we proved them wrong the moment we were there. We were already doing well enough that I knew they were mistaken in their assessment of what we were doing. But now, as the company has grown, we were originally on the show in 2013. It's now 2020. The company has grown dramatically and is continuing to. So I like being right. Who doesn't? I enjoy being able to say, see, I told you so. I like being righteously indignant. It's my favorite thing when I'm driving is to imagine that a cop pulls me over and I talk him out of a ticket with humiliating logic. But more importantly, I don't, I'm also completely willing to be proven wrong. I'm completely willing for someone to tell me that I've got my head firmly implanted up my butt with a case of cranial rectal cranial rectal reorientation syndrome. But in this case, it's not going to happen. In this case, it's very clear. Letting your body do what it's supposed to do is better than restricting it. How obvious could that be? Now, some people will say things that are, patently ludicrous. And I try not to be obnoxious when I respond to them and tell them they're patently ludicrous. But people will say things like, oh, we didn't evolve to walk on hard, flat surfaces or run ultra marathons on the roads. And I say two things. A, have you ever been to the places where we evolved? You would not want to walk on those surfaces at all. So the fact that we were able to means we're able to handle things like roads better than you can imagine, because the stuff that's, first of all, packed mud is as hard as concrete, and then there's all these things poking out of it. And there was never anything flat. There's stuff that you would step on that would be painful. So that's one thing. But the second point is, just because we didn't evolve to do this doesn't mean we can't do it. Doesn't mean we can't, that we're not able to do things. It just wasn't the situation we were in. We never evolved to do a double twisting, double backflip. I learned how to do one. So it's, there's lots of things that we can do that we didn't evolve to learn how to do. So I hear arguments like that, or when people say, well, you can't, mostly this is coming out of people. Human beings have this one particular trait that I find very unpleasant. We extrapolate our own experience to the rest of the universe, and we assume that
Right.
whatever we're experiencing, everyone else will. So people will say things based on their own experience, which I understand, that are just a little myopic. You can't stand on concrete all day, every day in bare feet. I go, well, tell it to everyone in our office who's been on standing desks that whole time. Tell it to all the people that I know who do all these things. So the our bodies, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir when I say this. The capabilities that we have are vast. And the reason that we don't experience much of that is because we've been limiting the experience. And one of the ways we limit it is by wearing shoes that squeeze your toes, elevate your heel, don't let your foot move, and don't let you feel.
Yeah, and I think part of that, I think it shows an attitude towards our bodies, right? That there's something wrong with them. They need to be fixed. We don't trust them. We don't, you know, like.
That's interesting. We certainly don't grow up paying attention to them in a way that's useful typically. So in elementary school, you know, you have recess where they force you to go out and do something for some amount of time. Then you come back. If you're engaged in some sport, it's very much going to be performance oriented. You know, it would be a very interesting thing if to graduate high school, you needed to be able to do a backflip. I'm making that up as a crazy example, but something where you had to learn to do something with your body that's really unusual, that requires you to pay attention. Or of course, if 90% of your time growing up and going to school wasn't spent sitting behind a desk. I mean, there's so many things that could engender a very different relationship with this thing. And the to your point though about thinking there's something wrong with it, of course you and I are not saying these things work perfectly. I mean, I can't scratch the middle of my back with my right arm, just the way that is. So my left arm I can. About things being broken, we also, another thing that human beings do is that we assume that what we perceive of as problems are in fact problems and not necessarily just a function of being a human being that works. So sometimes, you know, these things do weird things. That's what human bodies do. They're pretty cool. They're definitely not perfect. They definitely are, you know, wired where certain things are. I mean, so I have a compromised spine. I've got an L5-S1 spondy, a grade 2 L5-S1 spondy with a pars defect, for those who care about things like that. When I first got back into running, I was getting a lot of calf pulls and hamstring pulls and various things like that, where I could feel that the nervous impulse wasn't getting to the muscle at the right time. And so, you know, shit happens.
Well, absolutely. And also, if we go back to what we're talking about, you know, earlier, there's that habituation factor. You know, things happen, you adjust to them, and you forget that you adjusted. You forget that you forgot. Well, right? And that's the place where, for me, you know, my practice is a way of, like, that we forget, that things become automatic, that we have habits, that's actually good news. That's a feature of the system, not a failure. And our job is, you know, that's where learning is important, because otherwise we get stuck with what we've already learned.
It's so fascinating. I'm not wearing my glasses now because I forgot to wear them, because I'm usually okay in sort of computer distance. And sometimes I'll be reading a magazine at breakfast and then I walk away without my glasses. Well, I only started wearing glasses, how old am I? I'm 58. So eight, nine years ago. And I was stunned the first time I went to an eye doctor and they tested me and then put, you know, fake lenses on me. And I walked outside and realized that, did you know there's a thing at the end of trees called leaves? Have you ever seen those things?
No, what are they?
Like individual things that grow out of trees. It's not just a big green blob. I had no idea. And what I didn't realize is how I had habituated to having shit vision. And I had no idea. It was miraculous the first time I put a pair on. And similarly, I'm actually wearing hearing aids now because I had high frequency hearing loss. I had no idea. Then I got tested and they put these things in my ears and it was a miracle. So on the one hand, that habituation is really annoying and unpleasant. On the other hand, that's how we learn to do things. My undergraduate research actually was on cognitive aspects of motor skill acquisition. So it was all building out a map of how we habituate, how we create habituated movement patterns so we don't have to think about how to do these things so that we can actually do them, like tap dancing or double twisting backflips or, you know, things like that.
I didn't know that about you. That's cool. About that part of your
hearing aids.
That part of your background. No. I love our conversations because every time we talk, there's all these other connections have.
This is the thing. Look, you know, you even more than I, every time we talk, you mention something that you did at some point of your life, which is like, blah, 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 what? So, you know, it's very entertaining.
Well, Look, I it's exciting for me to talk to you because it's not only, I mean, there's not a lot of things in the world that I just think are great and I like to tell other people about because there's so much that isn't great. But also, you're this idea, maybe there's this thing about, what the potential we have as human beings to enjoy ourselves and the potential that our bodies have for us being able to do what we want, right?
It's a really interesting inquiry because so I'm 58 and change, and again, I'm still sprinting competitively, but dealing with an aging body is annoying as crap. Because I have the idea that it should be able to do things differently than it can.
Right.
And now that doesn't mean I'm thinking that it's totally limited to fill in the blank, but as a simple example, losing that last 5 pounds of body fat that would make sprinting easier because I'll have a higher strength to weight ratio. Really, really hard. It used to be I would skip breakfast once or twice a week and then I'd be fine. But now, the body just doesn't want to do that. And with the happiness thing as well, I guess where I'm going with this is one of the problems that we can run into is still imagining these future states of happiness or possibility, and then comparing where we are now to those imagined states and creating stress. So that doesn't mean we want to drop it, but having the right relationship with our expectations is something that is very, that's not a conversation that I hear very often, and one that I find very compelling because I mean, this is a total tangent.
Whoops, I lost you there.